Hey folks, welcome to the High Performance Human Podcast. My name's Simon Ward and I'm your host this week and every other week. You might have noticed a change a few months ago in the title of the podcast. It's now known as the High Performance Human Podcast. And there's a reason for that. It sort of embodies the way in which I'm trying to live my life going forwards and in which I'm coaching other people. So we don't just focus on athletic performance. One of my ambitions as I changed direction slightly on the podcast was to interview people who are high performing in other areas outside of sport. Some of these are clients of mine. Some of them are people I've been introduced to. But all of them have managed to create a balance between building a business, managing a family, training for their chosen sporting event and achieving their goals, getting enough sleep and recovery to keep the batteries recharged so that they're able to do all of these things to the best of their ability, and having a mindfulness that tells them when some of those plates that they're spinning are wobbling and they need to go back and attend to them. So today is one of those moments when I speak to a high performance human, and you'll hear me not just talk about their athletic achievements, but how they've lived their life to this point, what they did growing up, how they gained the qualifications that they have in whatever sphere, and how they built their business or worked their way up through the organization to reach the very top. They're interesting conversations. These people make mistakes. They're not superhuman. They're high-performing humans, but they make mistakes. But the key thing is they learn from them, and that's what you need to look out for and listen for. Aside from that, I just wanted to return to the COVID-19 crisis. It's an ongoing issue, and it will be for some time. And it's really taught me the value of community. The SWAT community was intended originally to provide guidance and advice for people wanting to do triathlon and to give them some structure and training plans. But it's become more than that. It has become a proper community. And that's been emphasised by the coronavirus situation. Now, you might have read or listened or heard people talk about SWAT. And if you feel like you'd like to join the group, then we still have spaces. And there is a link below which you can click on, which will give you more information and where you can make payment to join. Equally, you might find that your future finances are challenged a little bit by this current situation and you would like to join the group, but you think perhaps prudently it wouldn't be wise at the moment. Why not drop us a line? Tell us about your situation, why you'd like to join the group, and how we might be able to help, and we'll give it due consideration. We really will. I'd love to help everybody to try and join SWAT if I can. So if you want to do that, just drop down to the bottom of the page and you'll find an email link there for beth@thetriathloncoach.com. Okay, so that's enough of that. Let's crack on and get talking to a high performance human. Welcome to the High Performance Human Podcast, Gerard Gallagher.
Simon, I'm really, really happy to join you in today's podcast.
Yeah, it's great to have you on the show, Gerard. You're in the Emirates at the moment.
I am. I'm in the UAE on lockdown, like most people around the world will be listening to this podcast. So yeah, very much, following the rules of the land and, you know, behaving and trying to keep going. Keeping positive during these challenging times. But yeah, in the UAE, but it is still very sunny. So that's one small gift that we have.
It's been very sunny here, actually. I'm not sure whether that was a mixed blessing, because in the government's eyes, probably all the sunny days we've been having has encouraged people to go out and ride the bikes and go to the parks, exactly the sort of things they didn't want them to do. By the same token, if the weather we had in February was the same now and it was just pouring with rain, it would have made the whole situation seem so much more miserable and unbearable. Because, you know, for those people who do want to just go out and walk the dog or go for a bit of fresh air in the woods, it is so much nicer when the bluebells are coming out.
Much so. No, I have the same feeling here. I feel very privileged to be, at least from my balcony. And you might speak later on, you've seen my balcony, but from my balcony to look out and see the sea, although I can't swim in it, and see the sunshine. It's hard to be grumpy when the sun is shining, so, you know, long may it continue.
Yeah, well, the sun's gone in here now. It is forecast rain for today, so I can, if I'm a bit little grumpier on this podcast, then people will know why you're happy and I'm not so. Yeah. So, Gerard, I sent you some coach questions to have a look at. As I say to all my guests, As a good coach, I always follow a protocol with sessions. So we have a warm-up and then we get into the main part of it. So you had your warm-up questions. I'm going to ask you the first one last, actually, so I'm going to throw you straight away. But you've had a very successful business career to point now. On that journey, who's most inspired you of the people you've met and maybe of the people you'd like to meet?
You know, I don't know one person that I can give you a big moment, but at different stages of my life and my career, there's been different people who have gotten involved in my life who've really made a big difference. And it goes back to my earliest inspiration was my father and actually my mother. To see their work ethic and the way that they pushed themselves to really, you know, create a better world for them and their family. That was awesome. And my father was gifted at getting the best out of people. He owned the construction business and he was really, really gifted at that. And my mother was also very gifted at the commercial aspects of the business and discipline. So, you know, I learned an awful lot, and we might cover this a bit later, but I learned an awful lot about, you know, just being an amazing, you know, individual to communicate well and to have discipline really does and a big dose of hard work. So those are early visionaries. And then there's a couple of professors that in the middle of my life that made a big difference at university. I had a great fortune to invent something original, which was an equation, actually. And I could spend hours on this equation. It took me a year to figure it out. And this equation essentially used ground-penetrating radar to determine the state of play of rail tracks. And during the late 90s and 2000, trains kept flipping off railways. And you may have heard, there's so many crash assignments all around the world. Real issue. And with the University of Edinburgh, I spent some time with my professor on a one-year research project to try and work out how we could use radar on the back of trains to determine when the railway line is no longer strong enough to support high-speed trains in a proactive manner. So Professor Quentin Leeper was my professor at my organization, which was then Parmac Carillion, and Professor Mike Ford at the University of Edinburgh were two amazing people from academia and commercialization. They came together and they taught me the power of how to commercialize and make business opportunities out of great academic insight. Because on their own, they probably weren't going to do it, but together they were an amazing force. So I got a lot out of bridging the gap between academia and commercial. And then through my professional career, there's so many people that I can't list, but the, you know, my current chairman, you know, my previous chairman, you know, people I've worked with in my team, clients I've worked with, so many. So there's a couple of dimensions. So I don't have one individual, but at different points in my life, there is no doubt individuals have supported and helped me and nudged me, and I got a lot of confidence from that.
Well, maybe that leads nicely into our next question then, which is if you could choose anyone, living or dead, to mentor you now, you know, you got a month sabbatical from work to go and shadow somebody. Who would that be?
I am not going to be thinking about getting mentoring from people ahead of me in my career. I'm actually going to go the other direction. I would like to be mentored by some young people. And I would call it kind of reverse mentoring. I would like to know how they see the world more. I'd like to be more connected with how they see the world. Listen to them more and understand what I can do as a leader try and create a better working world for them when they're here. And, you know, I try to do that with my own children. I could do a better job of actually listening to them, I think. And as teenagers, they could do a better job probably of communicating, but, you know, that's for another podcast, Simon. But so for me, I do this in business and I'm going to do more of it. You've kind of reminded me of your question. I'm going to seek out a more structural reverse mentoring mechanism in my professional and private life, just to listen and be more mindful of what young people are going through, because they're quite scared about the world right now. And I want to really listen. And they also see the world in a different way. They see you in a different way. So I'm going to go backwards and really look to people maybe are seeing the world in a different way.
That would be quite interesting for coaches. We ask all of our coaches who are on our high performing coaching programs to go and shadow somebody. And
quite obviously, most people choose a coach that has been around a lot longer than them and has operated to the level higher than they do currently. And maybe that would be an interesting experiment for coaches to go back and learn from those who are just starting out on the journey, and I'd be asking them, you know, what would you like to be? What sort of coach would you want to be, and how, and allow that to shape the way you develop as a coach. Yeah,
I mean, I think that'd be really my view in my professional career. You know, when you leave university, you leave with a big. Just imagine you've got a big stack of books or notes for those people who go to tertiary education. That's what kind of I define as knowledge. Knowledge is really heavy. In the olden days, we used to put those notes and books in your parents' loft, and they sat there or in the garage, just in case one day you needed to get your knowledge out, put it on the table and show people how bright you were. Those worlds are ended. Those days have ended. But what my view is, professional knowledge, and you do an awesome job of this, is probably needs upgraded, reviewed, refreshed every 5 years. And I think about my own professional career, what I've started doing and what I do now. It's so different. So a chip refresh is important. To do that by going and spending time with younger people or people who maybe are more aware of new concepts, new ideas, are willing to put at risk the status of those big careers to try something different. I've always benefited from having exposure to that. So I think it'd be really interesting to see if that could work out.
Mm.
Yeah, it's a good call.
Well, maybe we'll try that, Gerard. I'll give you full credibility on that one. Full credit.
Yeah, that's good.
Okay, so we've done the inspiration thing. Let's say that other people looking at you and saying, "This Gerard Gallagher's an inspirational guy. We need to make a film about his life. We need to find an actor to play him." Who would you now? And let's say you've got the final word on this. So who are you going to choose? Now I'm looking at you now, and I can see that there are a couple of people that I might choose, but I'd be interested to know whether you would choose the same ones.
Well, as my mother has said to me many times, son, you're made for radio, not TV.
So I've heard that before. Not about you.
I think that's what you're getting at. But so there's no doubt. There's only one man who could play me, and that'd be Daniel Craig.
He wasn't on my list.
Yeah, I'm a massive Bond fan since I've been a baby. And I, Daniel's about the same age as us. He's in pretty good shape. I actually have in my apartment, I don't know if you've seen it, Simon, a picture of him getting out of the water with some blue shorts, swimming trunks. You know, yeah. That famous scene. And there's also me coming out after a 1.6 kilometer swim. Trying to feel that I looked the same, but I didn't.
Actually, now you mention that, I do recall seeing that photograph, and I do remember thinking, oh, there's a resemblance there. the two characters who I had in mind, certainly facially and follically, would be Jason Statham.
Yeah.
And Bruce Willis.
Well, I think you're probably right. It wouldn't be the first time that someone who's very ill-informed to say, you know, am I famous? And it's mostly Bruce they kind of think I'm related to.
Yeah.
So, follically challenged. But you know what, Simon? Grass doesn't grow on a busy road. For those listeners who have the same challenge.
We need to move on from those metaphors immediately.
Indeed.
So, whilst we're talking about films and characters like Daniel Craig and Bruce Willis and or actors like those and Jason Statham, they often have superpowers. So what superpower would you like to have conferred on you to live out the rest of your life?
I think the one superpower that I would really like is the ability to compress space and time. And we'll touch more on about my job. I just wish I had more time to spend with more people. And all the people I care about or want to help and support are just so far away in the world. So I have a very international voice. But so something, you know, like Doctor Who's TARDIS, something that can compress space and time so I could be with you physically today in a few minutes, but also be with my family in London or in Dubai or New York, wherever I would like to be. So that's the superpower I wish.
Yeah, that's the one I normally choose, actually. The ability to circumvent all of that hassly sort of waiting around in airports, slipping through the security, sitting on a metal tube for hours, just hours you'll never get back.
I'm way more advanced than that. I'm kind of thinking beam me up, Scotty type.
Yeah, no, that's the thing, the transporter thing. Just stand here. I want to go to London, right? You walk out the door the other end and there you are. Yeah. Yeah, that will be good. We're aligned on that one.
For sure.
So when I spoke with you recently, Gerard, and we're going to talk about books now, you put me onto a book that is very, very, it wasn't written about this particular time that we're in now, but it could quite easily have been. It's very predictive. Is The Seventh Sense. That's actually, I've not finished it yet, but I would say that's the best book I've read recently. And what about you?
Yeah, so The Seventh Sense is about, you might want to talk about it, but Simon, so the one of the reasons why I really like The Seventh Sense is part of my upgrade of my chip that happened recently at a session that I went to, I was so fortunate to go to, in San Jose in California with Singularity University. And it talks about disruption and disruptive events. And this is in November 2019, so it's only just a few months back. And this book, I think, encapsulates and starts to lay out in front of you what disruption can look like for every sector, every human being, every aspect of society, economy, and life. And it's a very simple concept. Imagine the world, but in a hyper-connected way. And that's what it is. And it's trying to show what disruption is going to happen in the future of the world when you start thinking about things connected. Really good example that stands out for me in that book is we have been taught, Painful was an engineer, but we've been taught all through life you need to learn multiple languages. But the prediction of the book, and I can see this coming, you know, really alive, is with really fast computing, with technology being accessible at a much cheaper price, it is highly likely the algorithms to translate my language to your language will be real time, which renders the need to actually have a need for learning a language. So maybe controversial, but challenging.
Well, so what you're saying there is translate Glaswegian into Yorkshire.
I don't think that algorithm currently exists.
But I get what you're saying, though. So you could be speaking Chinese to me, but as it comes out onto my computer screen, it's coming out as English, and then vice versa. So we don't need a translator. We have artificial intelligence and an algorithm that acts as a translator. Yeah.
So I use that book a lot to create a catalyst for certain clients I work with in our business to think about the world in a very different way. And I think, Simon, since November and today, the time of that prediction, as you touched on, is being compressed. It has happened way quicker than they expected. So really good read. I think one book that really has transformed me as a leader in business is a book called The Multiplier. And the Multiplier book, it's written by Liz Wiseman. It's a well-read business book, and what it talks about is how great leaders make people smarter. And I serve my whole ethos of my professional life essentially with components of this book. Two kind of things that stick out. One is when you're doing a large role, and you move through your career, ultimately you become someone who moves from a technical role to a leadership role to a managerial role. And technical leaders are the worst people sometimes to lead because you want to still be in control. You still want to understand the problem. You still want to really get involved. And what The Multiplier has taught me is that every time I get a new job, Simon, and I've had many new roles inside my organization, the first thing I do is set about putting myself out of that job, making myself redundant from that position. Because what happens as a consequence is I bring people to meetings. That means that I may no longer have to go to the next meeting with that client. I introduce colleagues to go to that support. I give people the opportunity to challenge themselves, to take on new problems, which ultimately they solve because they're really smart. And what this does is eventually it creates a lot of bandwidth for me personally to chew my pencil and to reflect about the future, to think about what's going to be next, to really get ahead of the immediate. And what it does to the team and the people I work with is it gives them huge opportunity to learn new things and support. So my mantra in every role I've taken is I set up myself to put myself out of a job every 3 years. That could be risky eventually, but so far it's paid off. And the final thing that comes out of that, Simon, that book, is the different types of leaders. And you'll recognize this when I say it. You have those people who are empire builders. So you're only in their team if you're actually physically in their team, in your business unit, in your office, in your P&L, in that structure, and they're your boss. If you're in that team, they're so supportive of you, they're so loyal. But if you're not in that team, it's not so good. Those are the empire builders who want to accumulate the resources, people, and that's how they get status. Then you have the other types of leaders who are called the talent magnets. And those are the beacons either in industry or in society who people just want to work with. Guess which one do you think ends up having the better outcome for the longer term? It's the talent magnets.
Yeah.
And it talks a lot about diminishing leadership behaviors and accelerating and multiplying behaviors. It is fundamental for anyone who really wants to think about how to get the best out of the team and give yourself some space. And I think we're going to cover this in a minute. How do I balance my job with my training and all these other balancing things? This is a really magic key to unlock some of the challenges of all of those plates you talk about spinning around. I'm not great at it, but I'm really conscious about it and I'm trying to get better and better.
Yeah, I think that'll probably come up quite a lot in our conversation as well, Gerard. He's been mindful of exactly where you are, exactly what your strengths and weaknesses are. There's a lot of people that, you know, they're not mindful. They're not mindful of what's going on around. So they leave a bit of a trail in the search for their perfection and they're reaching their goals. They don't care who they tread on and leave devastated behind them. The better people at achieving stuff and helping others go along with them are the ones who are mindful of what's happening.
Yeah.
I think.
I think taking people with you and being mindful of where they want to go and, yeah, it is as a must lead. So I'm sure Liz will be happy I plugged their book, but it is probably one of the best revelations for me. And if you want to think about the future, get onto the seventh sense just to start chewing your pencil with that extra time you've created through reading The Multiplier.
Well, we'll put both of those. I know we're going to have a lot of links on the show notes this week, so we'll put both of those books in there. I was just thinking back to that comment about making yourself redundant. It's something that I heard a couple of years ago with respect to coaching. And I suppose it's something that I've perhaps tried to practice for a number of years, but it maybe articulated well a couple of years ago. And I was listening to a coach talking about how he wants to make himself redundant. He wants to educate the athletes he works with so that they can do everything themselves, so they don't need him. And he tries to get them up to this position as quickly as possible so they can do stuff themselves. But the point at which they get to that, they decide to have him as their coach anyway. So it's choosing to have that person as a coach rather than needing to have them as a coach. And there is a difference there. And one of the things I find with a lot of coaches is that they're afraid to educate their athletes. They're afraid to share too much knowledge in case that person doesn't need them. So that's almost worried. They're worried about their own position. Of course, if you're talking about, you know, that's like the empire, but that's coaches probably an empire building. It's all about them. Whereas if you follow an athlete-centered and have an athlete-centered philosophy, it's about the athlete. And so you give the athlete as much as they need, but they still choose to have you because they realize that what they're after is more valuable with you alongside them.
And Simon, I think that's an awesome point. And, you know, you and I have worked together for a couple of years, right? And, you know, what I really value from you is very different to what I needed to get me up the learning curves. So now, and same with my own clients and, you know, in management consulting. If I continue, and clients pay quite a lot of money to get support to solve a problem. If I go in there and my only objective is to stay with that client as much as possible, doesn't really feel authentic. And that experience is probably going to end up in a bad way at some point. But what alternatively, what happens, and this is, I think, the role that you're suggesting now, is that client comes back to me a lot for me to shine a mirror on them, to get some guidance about stuff that maybe we didn't talk about before, or just to get some advice and support on a different dimension of what you've talked about before. And you create a much more fulfilling and wider relationship, which is more sustainable. So I'm a big fan of that. And I think, you know, that would do well for coaches as well, right? But sometimes it's really good for the coach to give you that. You need someone to be honest with you as well, right? And that's a big role of a coach, I think. It's not getting your false, false positives.
I'd agree. Coaches need to, I think the phrase is that they don't want to be blowing smoke up your ass all the time. They need to.
I think a little bit of time would be nice sometimes, Simon.
Point taken. So you were busy telling us, Gerard, at the beginning, making us all feel a bit jealous about your current location. I guess you've lived in a lot of places as your job's taken you around the world. Would one of those places that you've lived in be the one place you'd love to settle in, or have you got somewhere else where if money and time was no object, and you could do what you wanted from there, that you'd like to live for the rest of your life?
No, home for me is more about the people and the environment than it is a physical location, Simon. But I do, like everyone, I have wandering moments of where would I like to see myself. And there's just so many parts of that. I don't think any one place in the world is going to achieve it. So, you know, my own homeland of Scotland and Ireland is very precious to me. From perspective of the space, the outdoor, the culture, you know, living, you know, I've worked across all of Africa, India, and Middle East, and the energy that comes from hanging out with people here is just awesome. I love that. And then, you know, I go to other places in the US, and you have the traditional beachside stuff, and that's really cool as well. So I don't think there's one place that's ever going to satisfy my itch, my friend. I just need to know a lot of friends and go and visit them when I... But home is about where the heart is. You know, it's a cliche, but the people I'm with. And I'm really well-versed in, you know, making even my hotel room feel like home when I'm traveling.
I'm just thinking of a beach setting with a lot of Celts around and some vibrant people, and out the back behind your house are some rolling green fields. And then in the not too distant is some lovely white clad mountains where you can go and indulge your passion to go skiing as well.
Yeah, that would be nice, and probably a little bit of sunshine. I don't hunger for the weather from where I was born. That's probably one thing that I no longer. But you know, sometimes it's good. It keeps the dust down.
Yeah,
which is good.
Absolutely. Well, you get plenty of dust out in the Middle East, don't you? That's the problem. It's sunshine all day.
For sure.
So, Gerard, bucket list, things left to do in your life? I mean, you're not that old, so
No. I've got plenty of time, I hope, God willing. Simon, I really want to do... from a triathlon perspective, I really want to do Kona. I don't want to win it. I want to do it, but I also, it's not my only goal or ambition, but I really would like to do that, to push myself to get there. That's something I really kind of keen to do. And, you know, I think, you know, when and how to be determined, but that's something I want to do that, just because it's something, you know, it's a tangible goal. I am really bad, Simon. I'm really bad once I've achieved a goal to stop there. And I worry about what would happen after that. But so that from a triathlon perspective, I really like to do that for myself, to push myself to the limits. From a personal perspective, it's just, I don't have any major things that I want to do other than just continue to travel, be present with people. I would love to do something that really supported the world's need to get better at climate change. So there's something in there. I don't know what, but I'm really passionate about the need to leave this world in a better place for our kids. So something in my bucket list, you know, going back to my entrepreneurial invention story, if I had time and I had the energy and I had space, I would like to think really how I could contribute to a major impact on climate change, probably from an engineering technical perspective, because that's my kind of background. So no major bucket list events. I, as I look back in my life, there's been so many amazing events. And, you know, I've been so blessed to participate in many of those. And some of those, you know, are probably bucket lists in their own right. But I just can't keep stopping. So for me, a bucket list is a two-year list. Yeah. And then after that, I don't know.
The problem I find with bucket lists is that the more you're exposed to adventure and amazing things, you cross one off and then three more are added. So you go through life with a shorter span of time each year to try and achieve these, but the list gets longer.
You know, Simon, one of the things that you reminded me of, if I'm going in a slightly different direction for a minute, the problem with bucket lists is it is a destination. Mm. One of the things as I've got older and experienced more is actually the passage of getting towards a goal or an ambition or an event is actually way better than the event itself. So enjoying the journey rather than constantly worrying about the destination and the next destination. And maybe that's why I'm struggling to articulate like a one moment, because for me, it's all about really being in the moment and enjoying those experiences. So it's a journey towards a bucket list, maybe for me, is more important than actually getting in that bucket.
Well, you talked about going to Kona there, as you mentioned earlier. I ticked off that Kona goal back in 2017, and that really was my number one triathlon goal for the whole of the 30 years I've been involved in triathlon. It was almost 30 years to the day when I stepped onto the start line there. But as enjoyable as that day was, and it, you know, from the moment I got up to the moment when I crashed back into my bed sort of 20 hours later, it was a great day and I can remember every single moment of it. I'm now recounting, as I sort of put things together to write a book, the 30-year journey that got me to that place. And that has so many more experiences and memories, you know. And as I think about one thing, it awakens another memory. Like, oh, I remember that happening. Yeah. And oh yes, I need to put this in because that happened. And wow, this is when I met that person there. So that one day, which occupies one chapter, is preceded by 20 other chapters full of amazing people and experiences. So you're absolutely right. The journey occupies a huger part of my memory bank and my experiences than the actual.
And, you know, Simon, this is the gift of triathlon, right? And this is one of the things that I love, because when I travel around the world for my work, I now see the world in a different way. I see it in regards to I swim in different places and I look at the city in a different place. So when I go to Barcelona, I don't go to the Ramblas. I go to the beach and swim up and down the beach. It's a really good example. So you experience the place in a different way. I was so fortunate to be in Kenya recently, and I end up running with what I felt was a local guy, but he ended up being on the Kenyan team, Olympic team. And he took me out to the bush and we had a run. I didn't know the individual before that. Amazing. And I have so many experiences when you travel and you try to, you know, keep some discipline of training, it forces you to experience different things and meet different people. And you've always been very good at encouraging me to integrate with, you know, different clubs from in South Africa or wherever I am, trying to connect people, because the tri community tend to be very similar mindset people. They're very high performing, you know, positive people who want to meet and experience new things. So, you know, the world seen through someone who wants to continue to train and be a triathlete is a really interesting place. No hotel rooms for me.
I love that triathlon tourism. You know, that was what was behind my first Ironman. Let's not just do the one that's closest to home or the one that's cheapest to get to or even the one that has the biggest crowds. Which one can I find in a destination where I can go and visit a part of the world I've not been to before and experience a great place? And so I asked all my friends that had done them, which, you know, back in 1995 was nowhere near as many as people have done Ironman today, and there weren't that many to choose from, but Penticton in British Columbia was the one that seemed to get the most votes. And I went back there five times. And in fact, you know, the race as of our talking here is still scheduled to go ahead at the end of August. I doubt it will, but The race has returned to that location after an 8-year absence in while it's been in Whistler. So that would have been, that was supposed to be my last Ironman. You know, it would have been the closing of the loop, 25 years on almost to the day. So it would have been a nice sort of calendar anniversary, a nice one to round off on. And
do you why do you want to close the loop?
Because
you think you'll ever close the loop?
Well, I after Kona, I decided that I wasn't going to do any more Ironman. It just didn't. I like doing adventure. Multi-sport events, whether that's, you know, now that I've started being able to run again without any pain, I might consider the idea of doing an ultra run or something in the mountains. But the idea of doing more Ironman triathlons had sort of, the enthusiasm I had for it had worn off as a competitor. I still like doing the training, but I'd got into doing different sort of adventures. You know, we've been doing these multi-day cycles as a group of friends. We organize everything ourselves. We take our own support. We book all our own accommodation. And that's become a fantastic experience with a group of people over, you know, a week and a half. So I'd sort of thought, well, I don't need to do any more Ironman races. That one will mark number 20. It'll be 25 years. It'll be a nice point to close the loop. And I there was a point where I thought, I'm not sure how long I'm going to be able to keep running marathons. I can still keep swimming and cycling, but I don't know how long I'll be able to keep running this. So, you know, never say never, but that, I did think that would have been a nice end to the loop. But then there's other events that you might say it's an iron distance. So like the Celtman that you were going to do, or Norseman, or there's a whole series of those extreme triathlon events, which are in fantastic parts of the world, which would properly satisfy that whole triathlon tourism bug.
And that you know, that's what, of course, I was building up for the Celtman this summer in June. But it's been put back. I was so fortunate that my wife and I have got a place, so I can't wait to do that. It sounds really tough, but I think being in the moment, the, you know, being in some of the most beautiful places in the world. And so I'm really excited but scared. But that's what triathlon does to you. It pushes you, right?
Get out of your comfort zone.
Indeed. Especially if I've been living in the Middle East for so long and getting into that water. My Scottish roots and my my heritage of that, dealing with that temperature, is long gone.
Let's talk about your business life then, Gerard. You've sort of touched on it a little bit. I hadn't realised about that invention. I did mean to ask you: are equations the sort of things that you can patent? And did you get any sort of patent rights to that invention you created?
I did, and I do, and I continue to. It certainly
has it led to financial prosperity then?
I still have to go to work on Monday, Simon. Let's put it that way. Yes, it is patent, and I won't go into the IP deal between my company, the university, and me on this call. But it was available, and it's heavily used in that world. So, yeah, really excited about that. But that was one journey that I went down. So, maybe how did it all start for me? So, I grew up in Scotland, and you know, between Glasgow and Edinburgh, you know, very normal. Felt very loved, very close family, you know, a lot of cousins, a lot of people, small community. Like, I suppose the freedom that we all think about during the late 70s and 80s, when every summer it felt like it sunshine and you played football. So very, very, very amazing and fortunate that I had such a great upbringing and two inspirational role models in my parents, two big brothers who probably at that time I never felt were role models, but actually in hindsight they are. So that was that's where I started. And my father had a construction business, and like every small family business, you get, like, is in your DNA as soon as you're, you know, you can able to lift a shovel. Or so my first job was cooking for my dad's workers at lunchtime at the weekend, because then they used to have colour gas and used to have to make them sandwiches. So that was my job. I was junior chef, and they've given me a few pennies for that. And I graduated through my father's business, and ended up, he would trust me to run some of his parts of it. But that never was for me. I had a real love of engineering and breaking things, mostly, my father would say. So I went to university and studied engineering. And again, you know, very fortunate, the first in my family to go there, a great privilege, and really enjoyed that And then I joined the company and I spent the next 6 years underground. And this is where my follicle challenge came, I think. I had bad eyes and no hair the time I had finished because I spent all of my life digging tunnels, working on projects on the Jubilee Line in London to the Channel Tunnel, to Hong Kong Airport, to a diamond mine in Botswana. Really traveled around a lot with my organization as a young, you know, professional engineer, you know, supporting different projects around the world. And, you know, when I graduated in 95, engineers, unlike they are today, probably wasn't the most, where most engineers went into, because it wasn't the best paid career. Although it was deeply interesting and very satisfying, it was challenging. So with some business education, I then went into what's the start of my current career, which is management consulting. And now I'm a partner at a company called Ernst & Young, EY, which is a global professional services firm. So I joined that organization from industry after some you know, professional business qualifications, and put together industry and consulting together to then support clients. For those people who are not familiar with business management consulting, and my kids get really confused when I tell them what I do. It's like a business doctor. It's like someone who helps businesses, you know, keep them out of trouble or make their life better. A bit like a coach, Simon, if I'm honest, right? It's a bit like a business coach. And there's different dimensions to that. And my career inside consulting has been specializing in helping organizations that are in the energy or the asset intensive sectors like mining, or oil and gas, or oil field services, or utilities, infrastructure, transportation. So my background of civil engineering and construction and geophysics really came into play. But combining it from a business perspective, and I was really successful in the early part of my career using, I think, some of the tools that maybe my father taught me about humility, rolling my sleeves up, connecting people, doing things from the best place, and some of the things my mother taught me, which is work hard. Yeah. I made some mistakes along the way, no doubt, but I was so fortunate to be one of the ever youngest partners in UI to get to that status. And, you know, I've been so privileged since then to lead tens of thousands of people. In my most recent job, when I was a consulting leader for 92 countries across Africa, India, Middle East, where I learned an awful lot, got taught an awful lot, and experienced an awful lot. To my current role, whereas I'm the energy leader for my organization, where I help energy clients try to solve the world's biggest problems. And so this is really becoming my dream job, Simon. I feel like I'm the luckiest person every day I turn up. I know you had a question earlier about my dream job, and it's very different to this one, yeah. But I am so privileged that I have the opportunity to support clients deal with energy transition and help them in whatever we can using the best of UI's 350,000 people and brains. So that's a very different engineering, consulting, travel, but a lot of the core skills that of engineering is really good for consulting. But people work to work with people, Simon, not organizations. So for me, it's very much about the focus a lot on myself, not to forget where I come from, forget what it's like to be on the way up. It's really important to stay humble. And that reverse mentoring thing really works. There is no hierarchy when you're speaking to a 20-year-old.
Mm. I you know, get that when I speak to people at the level that you operate, Gerard, work incredibly hard and have to be incredibly focused. You know, you're at the top of that tree. So if we were putting you into athletic terms, you'd be a professional athlete. You're like a Premier League footballer. You're probably considered as one of the goal scorers for your teams. And you don't get to that level without incredible focus and drive and determination. But sometimes that leads to car crashes elsewhere. As far as you're comfortable sharing, I'm always interested to find out about how you balance that out with personal and private life and relationships as you're moving along. Because, you know, I know in certain circumstances other people have found that, yes, they've become very successful in business and they're, you know, in the ranks of the richest people in their neighbourhood, but their wives left them and the children don't talk to them. And that's makes you wonder how happy they ultimately are.
Yeah, so not to fall into the stereotypical thing you outlined there. Yeah, that's happened to me. There is no doubt that I was very young when I came into partnership, and I overemphasized, or I didn't realize how much I was overemphasizing my career and progression through that. At that point, I didn't have kids, but and it wasn't a disaster then, although my own personal health, Simon, you know, we've worked together now. I was 110 kilograms as a 31-year-old partner. That's not healthy. I was really working hard, not being aware of my own lifestyle, spending a lot of time, doing what I thought was the right thing, but actually I totally wasn't giving enough time to my then wife, my relationships. And it takes its toll. And, you know, again, the view that I had then was I'll fix all of that out once I achieve this career goal. Then I'll go back and recover it. It's not that simple, right? Humans are not that, you know, simple. And you know, I still have an amazing relationship with my ex-wife and we're still very close. But I do feel that I could have been more aware of that. And I speak about this openly, Simon, because I want, you know, people who work in my organization, not necessarily, unless they choose to do so, specifically to go down that alley in a blind way. And the same has also happened with my kids. You know, my kids, I've traveled an awful lot. I think every parent has to carry around a degree of guilt, mostly. I mean, guilt is probably one of the things that kind of summarized my mid-30s career. And I'm still working on that with my kids. I could do better. I want to do more. And, you know, that's something that I'm kind of keep focusing on. But as I moved into I've remarried my wife, Julian, who you've met, is a triathlete. And I am really purposeful. Not that she's shy of reminding me of this, but I'm really purposeful to not try and make the same mistakes twice and enjoy the journey and not necessarily chasing something in the end. So but my reflection is my health, my own well-being, took a real hit. I didn't spend enough time nurturing my private relationships, and that includes family and as well as partners. But if you get a second chance in life, it's not too late to revisit that. And that's been my journey since 6 years ago. And the health one was kicked off and inspired by one of my chairmen in the UK, a guy called Steve Varley, who I think you know, who could see a lot of his partner group getting really unhealthy. And he brought in some life coaches to help us. And that was a turning point from my health perspective. And I haven't looked back since, Simon.
So listening to that story of your personal life there, Gerard, working sort of intertwined with your business life, to use my favorite analogy of high-performance humans, is they're attempting to spin lots of plates. And if you've ever seen one of those circus acts, you'll know that the plate spinner gets one up and then he starts doing something else and then the crowd goes, ooh, and he runs back and he has to go and spin that plate again and then he starts another one, then he starts doing something else. And if you get that wrong, the plates start wobbling and then they smash. Now, it's always easier to go back to a wobbly plate and spin it up again than it is to pick up the broken plate and then glue it back together and wait for it to repair. And I guess that's almost where you said you were with your life. You were concentrating so much on spinning the business plate that the relationship plates weren't just wobbling, they were almost broken. But you were prepared to, at that point, say, right, well, I'll go back and mend those later. I'll just leave them there broken, then I'll go back and mend them there later. So at what point in your life, and what was the catalyst for, and we've talked about this mindfulness, and you mentioned that again there. At what point in your life did you start to become more mindful of all of this, that actually things need to be balanced out while they're still going rather than repaired later?
You know, there's a few points on that journey, but so certainly from a health perspective, I refer to the earlier conversation about, you know, an intervention that my organization took, which made me really mindful, started getting to understand about sleep, about diet, about rest, and the whole party about, you know, your well-being. You know, if you can't be fit and well, you're not really going to be that helpful in the organization. So that started that journey, Simon. I'll come back to how that flips to triathlon in a second. I think at this point, I really thought I was untouchable. And everything I could touch, I could mend. And that was wrong. And what made me really change was feeling quite lonely, actually, which is probably for someone who knows me and you think about how many people I meet and all the different things. There's definitely an element of loneliness in there, which is self-inflicted. I didn't pick up the phone, I didn't connect. I didn't speak enough to friends. I didn't just have a chat. I was always busy, busy, busy. So there was one event, Simon, which sticks in my mind, which changed my whole philosophy. And this was about 2 years ago. And it was an event. I was going to Nigeria. I was just beginning. I think I started working with you just then, and I was keen to keep my training. So I arrived in Lagos. And for those of you who have ever been to Lagos, the hotel structures are a little bit, they wouldn't be the same standard as you get in a New York or London. But there is a hotel that used to be the Intercontinental, but it's been taken over and it's called the Inter Lagos. So I stayed in Inter Lagos and I arrived from a flight from Dubai. And I had 4 days in Nigeria to really create a lot of brand positioning, thought leadership. We just published a lot of insight about how to support the emerging economies grow faster. But I was on my own with a team of EY colleagues for a 4-day trip around Nigeria, meeting ministers and TV and so on. I went for a swim, Simon, as soon as I come off the plane. So I arrived at the plane at 4 o'clock, went into the pool, wanted to get a few laps in at 4 o'clock at night. At 9 o'clock at night, I was unconscious in the A&E department in a hospital in Lagos. I went from being swimming to feeling something in my tummy, to ending up having poisoned my stomach lining with something that I don't know where I got it from. It could have been the pool. It might not have been the pool. The speed it came on, it could have been from the airline. I don't know. The fact of the matter was, at 9 o'clock at night, I'm on my own in Lagos. I call my organization's SOS line. They pick me out of my room, and I can't remember this, and they take me to an A&E hospital. And 3 days later, I wake up with all sorts of injections and drips, still in my jeans, not really knowing what's happened to me, and feeling the loneliest I've ever kind of felt in my life. And I'll send you a clip, Simon, because when I got out of hospital, and my colleagues in Nigeria did an amazing job of looking after me, no doubt. But it was really a stark message to me that I am not untouchable. I haven't invested enough in relationships in that plate. And that had to change. And there's a really funny, if you see how sick I was, and I was a little bit out of it. But anyway, typical Gerard at that point. I leave the hospital at 9 a.m. after day 4, and I go straight on to CNBC Africa to do an interview. And I'll send you a link so people can see it. The point of that note is, when you look at me on that TV, my collar and my tie was totally inappropriate. No one actually fixed me to get ready for this massive TV show interview. And I can barely even remember still having done that. I was so sick. I mean, I look back at that when I ever get out of kilter. I look at that video and I go, that is not what I want to be. So, you know, you don't have to be as an extreme as that, but that's really changed my life. And it's made me more purposeful and mindful, using your words, about those other plates, Simon. You know, I was searching to be fit and strong, and that part was good. Well, work was going well. But boy, oh boy, that was another lesson for me, that lying in Lagos, knowing what being injected into me or in what form, was quite scary. I ended up taking another 2 months having, you know, treatment in Dubai and getting over that. It was a pretty sick place, but emotionally, Thank goodness that helped. It helped change me. So there's a breakthrough moment, and I talk about that story as well to make sure that people, you know, really recognise that life out of balance is not nice.
Do you ever still get affected by that now?
No. I was very fortunate. I got a lot of support and advice, and I think 2 months of antibiotics, and eventually I've touched wood. I've got through that, but it was pretty challenging. But emotionally, it was more challenging to wake up not knowing. Anyway, so I'll send you the link, Simon. You know, if you
no,
can get some abuse, particularly my collar and tie arrangement. I think there's someone on TV who might have said, at least fix my, anyway.
Yeah.
It's a good memory for myself not to be out of balance. So that's my plate spinning.
I can't imagine if it would have been the BBC, they would have let you go on like that. There'd have been somebody in wardrobe that would have said, Mr. Gallagher, I think we need to do something about that shirt and tie.
Yeah, for sure.
I can remember going on the BBC one morning just after the Olympics. They sent a car to pick me up at 5 a.m. so I could get on at 7 o'clock I sat on the couch with Louise Minchin. And I got up, had a shower, did my hair, and of course I got there and they went, oh, we'll just do your hair, sir. And I'm like, I've already done my hair, thank you. There's not much of it. the BBC always double cover that stuff.
That's not the problem. But, you know, Simon, I suppose my final point on that, on how you identify that, is making sure you have enough people around you who you allow access to you, who can give you that point of view. And, you know, as a coach, you do that to me. Sometimes when I'm trying to go too far, maybe on one emphasis of, you know, I love my VO2 sessions because they feel good. You've got me into the world of math, which is amazing. I'm sort of a fan of that. You got me into the world of sleep and diet and, you know, HRV. So over time, you've certainly done that. And I've got a really good friend here in Dubai. And he's one of the people who probably suffered during my early parts of my career. And he's the one that got me into triathlon. He also provides me that honest feedback. So every relationship I go into now, with whether it be work or others, I really try to seek that, give people permission to call it out. And I think, you know, leaders should do that. I think we owe it. And we also own role modeling for our people. So I'll tell you one thing that happens in my life a lot. You know, my business operates in 7-minute units. So my life could be scheduled into 7-minute chunks through the day. And there's always someone who will want to have a meeting with me, or I want to have a meeting with them. And quite quickly, I can go through and have 20 meetings, either on video, over the phone, face-to-face, in a day. That's overwhelming when you're running and you don't have actually any time to do work. So one thing that I regimented, and it's really, I would encourage all leaders to think about this. For 90 minutes during the day, I would walk out my office where everyone would be there in the floor. I walk through that floor with my gym kit and I would go to the gym right in the middle of the day. And I would have my lunch and I'd come back and I would work. And you know how many people got cranky with me because they couldn't get into my diary, but they see me walking out? Mm-hmm. And I say, I will meet with you. I'll meet with you on the running machine or on the bike machine. We can talk. But I am not ever going to allow this to creep over. And sometimes, Simon, to be honest, it does creep over. And that's a choice that I make and allow it to happen. But it's really specific. But you know how much feedback I've had from people about how positive it is for leaders to give them the mandate to do the same? Because if I can do it, I expect you to do it. And I can't overemphasize anyone who has that opportunity to lead and to shine a light on this, role model it, please, and just talk about it. That makes a huge difference to your people.
I do hear a lot, perhaps not from people who are operating at your level, Gerard, but from maybe in that middle section, is that they often feel like there's a lot of pressure to be at the desk and be seen to be working all of the hours. So they're fearful of taking time out for lunch. It's almost become an office culture to not have lunch, to sit at your desk working, and to wait until the final whistle before you go home, so not leaving until you've finished your work. Now, there's an overwhelming amount of evidence to show that taking breaks during the day actually improves productivity, is good for your mental health as well, particularly if you can get outside and get some fresh air, some sunlight. You can go and walk in the park for 10 minutes. You can go and do a bit of deep breathing or some meditation type stuff in whatever form that takes. But the weight of evidence to show that is overwhelming. And most business leaders have been exposed to that evidence at some point, you know, in the same way that your company did. And yet still at the lower levels, it seems like people are fearful for that. So when you've got a leader who is showing the path and saying, look, I'm prepared to do this, I am as busy as you are, but I'm prepared to schedule 90 minutes out of my day to go and do this. It's a part of my daily discipline. And it actually enables me to be more productive, not just today, but in the long term, because I'm healthier. And, you know, again, the body of evidence pointing to this is huge, that mental acuity and responsiveness and everything else is so much greater if you're fit and healthy. You don't have to be triathlete fit or marathon running fit, but you have to be certainly getting up to having a balance of daily exercise and practices.
Yeah. You know, Simon, I think the world you describe has been turned on its head as a result of the lockdown. Mm. So how that culture can continue after this lockdown when people are at home and we're forcing to trust people, those cultures of being at your desk have just been torn up and thrown away. So I really hope that people will benefit from that. What I've actually seen in my own business is it's unfortunately created another new culture of you. If you're a young family, you're both working, you've got homeschooling. That's a lot to juggle in a household, which ultimately ends up people working longer hours and more stressful. So one thing that my organization were really, 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 really purposeful of is as leaders not to set up sessions or meetings or calls or events that's going to add more pressure and being really allow people to call it out if they do. So I'm really pleased about that. So I hope that culture will get brushed under and swept away as a result of one of the positive things that may come out of the COVID response. But, you know, your point is right. What the middle managers in most organizations tend to be the people who are not talent magnets, but empire builders. And visibility means control. Culture means control. And I share with anyone, I don't think that they will be the most successful leaders if they don't allow the people to expand and allow some control over their own work-life balance. A couple of other things though, Simon. You know, I don't go out for dinner at night unless it's really, really important. And I certainly don't indulge in kind of late night sessions, you know, where that also is a bit of a macho culture. And if you're a young family or a young dad or a young mum, that might not necessarily be the right thing. So I'm really clear that those events to support our people don't have to come at the price of their own life and well-being. So I'm a massive fan for people who know me to have the breakfast meeting. Big fan of that. It gets over, you get it done with. There's no alcohol or no need for alcohol. Sleep's done. You got on with your day. So again, being very conscious about what you do and what you ask others to do is so important. And, you know, I would encourage everyone to really think about their day, their life, and those plates. And just ask some people to think about it, right?
Let's talk about your triathlon career then, Gerard. You've not been in it for very long, have you? You've not been a lifer like myself.
No.
But I welcome you to the party late.
Thank you.
But you know, it's an exciting new world and full of different opportunities. But in order to particularly do events like the Kelpman, it requires a fair amount of commitment over the long term, and it requires a fair amount of exercise on a weekly basis. Not the exercise levels that your company doctor will be saying, well, Gerard, if you can get a 45-minute walk in most days you know, do a bit of vigorous walking, you know, up the hill if you can, that'll keep you fit. And maybe get a personal trainer once a week to give you some strength and mobility. We're not talking about that level of exercise. We're talking about a couple of hours a day into what you've already described is a busy schedule, balancing, managing this huge group of people and relationships that you've become more mindful about. So how do we find space and time to start spinning another plate and still without sacrificing sleep and eating at your desk and all those other bad habits?
So no magic bullet here, Simon. So, but it is discipline and structure, and having an amazing team and talking about, you know, what you're doing and why you're doing it. So, you know, the most challenging I find to keep the exercise going is when I travel long haul. And, you know, last year, and I'm not proud of this, I spent way too much time in long haul flights as I go about kind of supporting our people and clients around the world. So when I travel, it is really easy to make a bunch of excuses not to do anything. So I'm really disciplined ahead of traveling about, and this is just practical stuff, and we've talked about this, about with my organization, making sure I stay in a hotel or accommodation that's near a university swimming pool, Olympic pool, or a running track, or I've checked into the local tri club or cycling club and hired a bike. So I put a lot of prep into going around there. And, you know, when I'm in a long haul, so I mean, recently I was in San Francisco, and that's 17 hours. And that's not an irregular experience for me. I end up staying, I've started staying the weekend to give my body opportunities to recover and enjoy, I suppose, the beauty of that triathlon, that triathlon tourism you talked about. But there is no, in the humdrum of every day, it is getting that session in, disciplined 45-minute run in the morning, whatever it is, my breakfast onto my conference call, having my afternoon slot if I'm doing a little bit more, and then maybe before bed, a little bit more. And between those three levers, I really, really plan my day accordingly. And you've met my, you know, my amazing support assistant, who we worked on this together. The three of us, we talk about how to do this and moving stuff around. The other thing I would say, though, is, and you know, as well as no excuses, don't beat yourself up. If you're tired, and you keep telling me this, and I'm not the best at it, if you're tired, have an extra hour in bed, Jared. Don't necessarily feel. And that's taking me time. And what I've found, Simon, in my little experience of being a triathlete, is that I'm actually training much less intensive 3 years on than I was when I started. A lot more math. You know, I'm sure you talk a lot about math, so people will know what I mean. Low intensity training. And I really look forward to those high impact training sessions. But a low intensity session is actually a very cathartic, relaxing experience for me. And I really look forward to that. And I can listen to audiobooks. I can listen to webcasts from my organization. I can really let myself go and not really worry too much about the training. So little techniques like that, but it is structure. It is genuinely no excuses, but not beating yourself up if you're tired and being a bit more relaxed. And that seems to be working. And, you know, you were fortunate enough to be here with me a few months ago, and my PBs are getting better, right? I'm getting faster, and but it feels like it's more part of my life now. It's not something I do around the edges. It's part of something I do in my life. But sleep and diet is really important. But, you know, I'm also a human being. So I do like to break out and catch up with my friends. And I think you talked about in your previous podcast about, is it in the Navy or the Admiral, if you open a bottle of red, you have to finish it. So,
yeah,
you know, I think everything in balance, Simon, but that really has helped me being really structured and thinking ahead and planning a week and, you know, doing those 3 week training into training peaks and really structuring that has allowed me the ability to keep that balanced.
When you talked about being in San Francisco, that's what, 13 hours behind Dubai time?
Yeah.
So yeah. When you're traveling so much and crossing multiple time zones, that can play havoc with your sleep, with your circadian rhythms, all sorts of things, your eating patterns, your bowel movements, everything. And it's not like you're going to San Francisco for 2 or 3 weeks where you get used to it. You're there for a few days, and then you might be going back to the East Coast. So you've gone forwards another 3 hours, then you're back to the UK. So you've gone forwards another 5 hours, then back to Dubai. So it's forwards another 4 hours. Then you might be back to the UK. So what strategies have you put in place to help your body cope with those debilitating effects of jet lag and time zone change?
So a couple of practical things is stay away from alcohol. Even though you might think it helps you go to sleep, particularly in long haul flights, I have a metal bottle that I carry around with me. It's a 1 liter bottle. And the reason why I carry that is it forces me to drink more, and it forces the airline to give me enough water. And they get a bit grumpy after six. But in a long-haul flight, I will drink at least between 4 and 6 liters of water. So staying hydrated, eating healthy. So I often get the vegetarian or the fruit, just to make sure. Or even sometimes I take my own food for the first part of the meal. And, you know, trying to get the sleep in. So on the way there, I tend to do a bit of work, but not a lot. I do a lot of reading and reflecting and catching up. When I get there, Simon, I really go into the time zone that I'm in. So the first thing I do is when I get to the hotel, I take my shoes off. I take my socks off. And I'm a big fan of not wearing shoes and socks anyway. And I just walk around and I kind of ground myself. Mm-hmm. And that might sound a bit hippie-ish, but for me, it's an important thing. And then I go for maybe a 15-minute run to acclimatize to the neighborhood, to that. But also, Simon, one of the things that I have the gift often of controlling is my flight schedule. So if I can, I would do, you know, a 2-hour math run before I fly, or a really good intense workout that gets me onto the flight, knowing I've done that, good shape. And then ultimately, it is not giving yourself a hard time, and I can adjust my body clock probably 2 hours a day. But recognizing I still have a job to do in Dubai when I'm in San Francisco, I could quite easily, you know, be working 24 hours. But so grounding, getting as much sleep as you can, not using the flight to really, you know, overwork, using it to reflect, healthy diet. And then when you're there, get onto the running machine or do something that grounds you, and then just take it easy on yourself. And, you know, the lesson of when I'm there is not to pack my schedule so much. So the same discipline as those structures that I have when I'm at home, I run my diary when I travel. Hmm. It's not magic. It's hard, Simon. It's hard. But I found that, you know, having a maintenance regime allows me to go to the local university, go to the pool, meet some different people. So I get quite excited about where triathlon takes me. So that's a bit of motivation when it's much easier to go down to the bar and have a beer with your buddies.
Sounds like there's not a lot of room for fluff in your life, you know, social media, watching Netflix, that sort of thing. Do you ever get a chance to catch up on those at all? Or you said you listen to audiobooks. You listen to the occasional podcast, because we've chatted about some of those.
I do. I've listened to a few of yours. So I audiobooks is my thing, particularly for my long exercise, my long runs. I really like that. I like a good movie, I like a good box set. So I would be known to, you know, indulge in a long haul box set binge. So yeah, no, I enjoy that. But I per week, maybe half an hour TV. It's not a big part of my life. There's so many other things to do. And I keep up to date with, you know, stuff through what everyone else does. So yeah, no, I not a lot of time for fluff. And I think structure, and Simon, you know me, I'm not someone who's so regimented, and I've learned to not give myself such a hard time. Mm. As long as you understand why and you're aware of your own body and how you're feeling. Training when you're tired is not good.
It often conversations like this keep looping back to that word mindfulness, don't they? It's almost like the anchor in the ground for living a balanced life. One has to be mindful. So, you know, you'll be engaged in a work project. You'll be training for the Keltman. You and Jules will be doing something, and you can get heavily engaged. People that reach the top of the tree in whatever profession tend to be really good at focusing on what's happening at that particular moment. But it's easy to get lose focus on the other stuff, and that ability to be mindful and just think, well, okay, so I'm training for Ironman, but I've still got a job to do, and I've still got a wife here, and I've still got children there that I need to connect with, is what helps all of this, sort of, I suppose, going back to the plate spinning analogy, it's what helps you to keep the plate spinning without allowing any of them to drop. And you've got to accept that there are times when you will be focusing on spinning this plate, and some of the others will get a bit wobbly. That's how it is. But it's been able to reflect on when you're in that situation and then pull back from it rather than just carry on spinning that plate whilst all the others are crashing.
You've got it. I think your point about how do you know when you're out of balance, I think is probably the key thing for people to set up that kind of infrastructure around them, which is friends, coaches, or mindfulness and self-awareness. So you're absolutely right, Simon. And, you know, my job goes through some really, 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 really busy times. And I get cranky that I can't do my exercise. Mm. But over time, I've also realized that I might have a lower ebb in my workload, and I can do a little bit more, and I'm really thankful to have that balance. So I think it goes back to don't beat yourself up if one is slightly falling because you're investing in another. But that relationship, friendship, you know, human, you know, son, daughter, wife, husband, father, cousin, friend, don't let that one go. That's one that you, I think, generally, is the one that, in my experience, is the one that you take more for granted. And that's probably the one that, in my reflections, that needs more care and attention. Because if that's healthy, it keeps all the other ones going as well, right? And, you know, I go back to that Nigeria hospital. I wasn't worried about my career. I really wasn't worried about my training. Yeah. You know, I was, you know, lonely, and I kind of had a mirror shown on me that that was life out of balance. Hmm. So that's kind of my kind of reflection on that. But, you know, no one's Superman. I'm not Superman. I get it wrong sometimes. It's good to have a partner now who's, you know, also equally into triathlon. So we have a lot of good things that we can do together. And but I can't have all my friends triathletes.
Well, it's probably a good thing as well, because it gives you a different perspective on the world when you sit down and have dinner with non-triathletes. And I know quite a few professional triathletes who they have friendly relationships with other triathletes, but their friends are people from outside the sport. Because, you know, I guess if your job is training 30 to 40 hours a week, when you go out for dinner, you probably don't want to talk about what's the best power meter or what do you think of the new Nike Vaporflies. You want to talk about the economy or politics, maybe, if that's your thing, or just something other than swim, bike, and run.
Yeah. And but I do love a good power meter discussion as well.
Yeah, well, that's also another podcast, I'm afraid.
You're right. I think it's very easy for people to have a spike in one direction and surround themselves with people who reinforce that spike or make them feel good about that spike. That's not a healthy position to be in.
That's that whole echo chamber thing, isn't it? That we got accustomed to. Well, you've touched on briefly, Gerard. We talked about the seventh sense, and we talked about how the world is always changing, but these last few months have accelerated beyond all possible comprehension. Really, how quickly the world is changing, is going to change. I guess being involved in such a big company as EY, and with your various consulting departments and number crunching and data crunching, what do you see is going to be the biggest changes to the way we live our lives going forward from here?
Yeah, that's a really good question, Simon. And it's one that's probably quite contemporary. And, you know, whenever this podcast goes out, I don't know, but we're talking, you know, at the end of April 2020 on this one. So at the moment, there's three stages.
Things could have changed a lot by the time it comes out. Yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. So I'm very aware. I think speed is probably one of the things that is now a new normal for us. But, you know, I think, and, you know, about my own organization and about our clients, and three things about helping them get through the now, you know, what's in next and then what's beyond. And as we speak right now, we've been really helping people keep their staff and customers safe, get them set up to allow the business to continue to operate, and just essentially try to protect as much as possible. The work we do with governments is actually helping design and create stimulus packages around the world that's going to fulfill this massive collapse in the economy. So we're coming at it from both ends, but it's all hands to the pump to get through the now. That's also quite dangerous, because people will throw as much resources, as quite rightly they should do, to try and protect and salvage human life as much as possible. But my worry is that we don't keep enough thoughts about what's going to change. So I understand that, you know, in the UK, for example, we have the furlough and we have the rescue packages for employers to pay and keep people in gainful employment, in readiness for coming out of the crisis so they can go back to work quicker. I love that. But what if you're in an industry that doesn't exist after this? What is the point of the government spending time in essentially continue to support redundant business models? And I think that's going to happen a lot, Simon. They're going to see governments around the world supporting businesses that they're really, really important to get back into work as soon as possible, and those businesses that are not going to exist. So I know in my own organization, we've got 330,000 people around the world working and serving and supporting our clients and each other on Microsoft Teams. We also have some of the biggest real estate footprints in the world. It's not going to take as long to understand that maybe that physical real estate structure is no longer required at the level. So if you're in the real estate market, if you're in the corporate real estate city center market, it's challenging. Yeah. So, what's the world going to look like for them? Could create more opportunities for affordable housing, but it's certainly going to change the dynamics of city centers moving forward beyond anything we recognize. Hotels, the same. Business traveler is probably the biggest proportion of most city center hotels, one to watch out for. And so those are some of the losers. The aviation industry, I think, is under a lot of stress. And I think that's one to watch, and BA are going through their challenges at the moment. So, Simon, there is definitely industries that will not come back in the same way, because the next and beyond is totally different. And that is the speed of digitization. The ability to people to work remotely and do their jobs has gone through a revolution in a time that is unprecedented. So anything that thinks, and this is why The Seventh Sense is an amazing book, it talks about the new world in a world of connectivity. So think about your business in that form. The other area I would say beyond is the impact it's had on the greenhouse and climate change. And it sounds strange as an energy leader to say this, but our addiction to oil and the fundamentals of oil in our economy and geopolitical issues, the fundamentals of oil. Just imagine, in my research in our organization has shown in 2 years from now, if Simon Ward puts a solar PV onto his roof, he has an electrically powered car with battery and storage capacity. In 2 years, the price of doing that, Simon, will be less than the price of you buying it from your local utility. Something we call a prosumer. And I think after this, people want to be more in control of their own environment, energy, food, water. So you're going to see a lot of people trying to protect, quite rightly, back to Maslow's hierarchy of needs, the security of their world. So that's going to change the way people consume and use energy. And, global demand for oil and gas is 6% down. That's six times more than it was in the decline in 2008. That's just changing the geopolitics of the world. So my hope, and it is so devastating to see how many people are dying around the world, but we will get through this. And the work we're supporting organizations and businesses do is to understand how you can change your business model to benefit from acceleration and digitization. A more mobile workforce, when I can bring a consultant from Saudi Arabia to serve a client in New York without going on a plane. Wow, I now have a global workforce that truly can be deployed in a much better way. So if there's a downturn in the Middle East, I can deploy those people to an economy that's doing better. So trying to think about your organization in those terms. But really simple things I hope will come out of this. I think we're more caring to each other than we've ever been, certainly in my kind of professional generation. More caring. I see people genuinely hanging around to allow folks to answer when you say, "How are you today, Simon?" It's not just chitter chatter. They actually want to know. So I'm seeing a lot of humanity's good sides coming out, which is amazing. I'm also seeing, a lot of the business norms around, it's all about growth, it's all about commercial, it's all about shares, it's all about wealth creation. I'm seeing that being traded right now for what I think will be called a quality economy. An economy that define success in terms of contribution to the environment, societies, people, you know, culture. A much more rounded perspective. And, you know, Davos this year was starting to go there. It talked about that. And, you know, we call that long-term value. I'm seeing a much more holistic view with my clients saying, how do I tilt my business towards creating a quality organization rather than one that's finely tuned for commercial benefit? So when I have a down moment, and there's many of them, like most people who's locked in, and I'm doing my 16-floor stair up and down that you gave me, Simon. So thanks for your innovation on those exercises up and down, my time trial. I think about the positives that's coming out of this, and I'm really, really positive about some of the outcomes. It is absolutely tragic that it's taking this to do it, but speed, the new normal, thinking about how you can benefit and support society in a more holistic way, these are positive things.
I don't need to defend my actions on your training program, Gerard, particularly as you encouraged me to give you those occasional hard sessions, and you've said so on this podcast that you actually quite like those. So
I do.
I was actually applauding myself on that innovation as well, and the ramps out the car park.
The ramps out the car park. I really appreciate your ability to get yourself fit for the current normal.
No, I'm doing my best. Yeah.
So a time trial on Strava, though, is quite a hard thing to log. It gets a lot of people confused. Stay a time trial.
Yeah, I know. Well, Strava's a whole nother. That's another podcast discussion, like the parameters, really, isn't it?
Yeah. But yes, Simon. So that's kind of get through the crisis, thinking about the world beyond the crisis because it will come back. And using this time to get your infrastructure, your thoughts, your strategy. And one thing that is always, if you look back in history, is we always overestimate the pace of change rather than underestimate it. What I mean by that is, the short term, we always overestimate in the short term and underestimate the impacts in the long term. I know there'll be people listening to me going, nah, we'll be fine. We'll be back to the way it was. I really encourage you to surround yourself with people who can give you examples that is not going to be the case. But it's not all doom and gloom, and innovation will come out. So we are, and it's human conditioning, we are underestimating the long-term impact, what this has had on our world and those norms that we've lived with for essentially since the Industrial Revolution.
But you know what, though, Gerard, if a world emerges that's like the one you describe, where we are using our cars less, there's less pollution, there's probably less air travel, people start to think about each other more than just the selfishness of themselves and their own journey through life. To me, that sounds like a better world. And I'd be happy to work towards that and to help other people sort of see that as well.
Yeah. It's definitely, and we have this purpose in my own organization to create a better working world. Mm. And there is no doubt. And it's a huge cost, Simon. But if there's ever a way to leave a legacy to all of those unfortunate families and people who have, you know, succumbed to this awful, it is making this change for the better stick. There's no better way to leave a legacy of those people who have been affected by this awful situation.
Well, and if we round off this discussion, Gerard, by talking about the essence of a high-performance human, then living that healthier life, living a life that helps other people fulfill their ambitions as well as your own, sharing, developing relationships, rekindling relationships with friends and family, and just communicating more with other people, rather than just ignoring them and getting in your own little bubble. That's a nice recipe for a high-performance human, really, and a high-performance human life.
Yeah. As a good management consultant, you've got the six or seven dimensions of a framework of what high-performing humanity, I think, will look like in the next kind of after the new normal, right?
Wow.
But it doesn't sound awful, Simon, does it? When you describe that and it sounds a lot more holistic than what I think people think high performance is. Mm. But we're all human. And that's my learning, is we're all human, and we need to kind of give each other a break and give yourself a break.
Yeah, I like that. My brother does a lot of this sort of work, and he's always talking about having compassion for yourself. And that's something I've mentioned to you sometimes when we talk about training, is, you know, you want to push on and push on and your legs are hurting. It's like, just sit down for a moment and say, thank you, legs, for all this work you've done. And today I'm going to give you a day off, and have a bit of compassion for yourself, have some compassion for others, which, as you say, it's Thursday as we're recording this. So in a few hours, we'll all be stood out inside the front of our houses clapping for key workers, not just the NHS, but for everybody that's helping keep the world moving at the moment. And, you know, that's we've seen glimpses of that occasionally in the past, but it's more sustained now. And again, I hope that perhaps once we start to move on from this, these are some of the things that stick.
Yeah, and, you know, it makes it laughable, some of the things that we were worrying about before this, you know, trade wars, you know, trade barriers, you know, immigration. These are all really important things, but, you know, it shines a light of relativity onto these things that we're worrying about, and it's really emphasized the important things in the world. And I'm so excited about hopefully sustaining this time. An awful cost, as I mentioned, and it's not the end, but it's forced us to really look at the way we're occupying this planet.
Well, Gerard Gallagher, thank you so much for coming on to the High Performance Human Podcast. I think you've definitely epitomized what I had in mind when I was sort of thinking of the avatar of High Performance Human. So thank you for sharing that wisdom with us.
I mean, for all your help and giving people the opportunity to kind of think like this. So keep doing your good work.
Thanks, Gerard. Take care out there.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Right then, that's a wrap for this week. Thanks again for listening. As always, I appreciate that you have plenty of choice out there in podcast land, so it does mean an awful lot to me when you come back regularly. If you enjoyed the podcast, please could you hop onto iTunes or Podbean and leave a rating and a comment if you can. Apparently, it's really good for the ratings, although to be absolutely honest with you, I have no idea how they work these things out. If you like the way I roll and you find some synergy with my approach to life and sport, maybe be interested in joining my SWAT Inner Circle training group. If you are, please just email beth@thetriathloncoach.com for more details. You can also use that email address to ask for my special free gift, which I have for you, which are my top 25 tips on how to be a high performance human. Okay, that's all for this week. I'll be back next week with another great guest. So for now, enjoy the rest of your week.